Hi everyone, it's David Wood. Welcome back to Wood on Words, the podcast for all things writing and publishing. This is episode 53. We're going to be talking about cons and author networking with Alan Baxter. Been a busy week for me. I wrapped up the draft 0.5 of the next Sam Astin thriller, which we think we finally have a title for. We're calling it Overlord, unless we come up with something better. But that draft weighed in at almost 15,000 words, and that's an outline. That's why I call it draft 0.5, because it's like writing a novella or a novelette, depending on the project, when I'm doing this stuff. But I'm excited about how it came out, and I think it's going to be a good book. And I write that with Alan, who is my guest today. So that was one of the big accomplishments. Also, I proofed the audiobook for Locke, which is Dane Maddock number 9. And am in the process of proofing the third Jade Ehara book, Exile. So lots of audio proofing, which is one of those things that I enjoy, but it's time-consuming, and it kind of limits what else you can work on, because you have to be listening fairly closely to what the narrator is saying to make sure they're getting everything right. And so that saps my productivity in other respects. But, you know, that's just something you have to do, and it's good. Still working on couple of smaller projects, and I've got the outline ready for the short story that I was invited to contribute to an anthology. And the issue with that one is, as with most things, whenever I come up with an idea, it quickly becomes a big idea and it grows, and I start thinking of subplots and backgrounds and all kinds of cool stuff to put in, and suddenly it's no longer a short story. So we're going to see how that works. I've managed to write a few short stories in recent years, but it's never easy for me. I'm definitely a longer form writer. I love the novellas and short novel length. That's what I really enjoy, because I like those old pulpy adventure novels that are fast-paced, quick reads. So anyway, we'll see how that goes, but that's one of my big projects for this week. And so on the writing front, those are the main things. Also working on a lot of Griffin Wood stuff and some Adrenaline Press stuff, but that's a constant thing that we keep working on. So that's it for my own writing. A couple things happening in the publishing industry. One of them is that there's been a crackdown on Amazon with erotica. And even things that are not straight up erotica, maybe they're paranormal romance and things like that, but if they smack of erotica, and this is one of the things that's really weird, there are new sex trafficking laws that have been passed. And I haven't read deeply into what they are, but basically, the laws are so tight now that if a product is deemed as even encouraging any kind of sex trafficking in any way, it's going to be a problem. So if you write a novel that is perceived as encouraging sex trafficking, well, that's going to be a problem. So Amazon has started rank stripping books that really aren't about sex trafficking, but that they are fearful could be construed that way. For example, one of the subgenres in erotica is what they call reverse harem, which is basically, instead of the guy having a bunch of women, it's the reverse, where a woman has a bunch of guys who worship her and she has her own harem. And, you know, it's just a flipping of the traditional trope, and it's fun for people to read. And, you know, we're not talking about necessarily forced sex slavery or anything like this. I haven't read any of these, but I know some people who have written them. And, you know, the guys are voluntarily participating in the stories. It's just that the woman gets to be on top, I assume literally and figuratively. But those are beginning to get rank stripped as well, because Amazon is just reacting strongly to these new sex trafficking laws. So if you're writing in those genres, it'll be interesting to check into. Another thing I wondered about is there are certain authors, you know, sci-fi, thrillery guys, old school especially, whose work could be construed as the guy having a bit of a harem. My guess is that they probably won't get rank stripped. We won't get into the reasons for that, but technically it could happen. We'll see how that goes. But anyway, something to keep an eye on. If you're writing romance, erotica, or anything that brushes up against that, keep an eye on it and make sure you're keeping your rankings. But apparently Amazon has announced that they're really going to continue to, can't think of the word I want to use now, to suppress erotica. And it sounds like they really would rather not publish it at all. So anyway, that's something to keep an eye on. Another thing, it's not something that's happened, but people are beginning to be concerned about, is that the United States is passing a lot of tariffs, and one of these tariffs could potentially affect publishers, especially newspapers. Apparently, that industry gets most of its print in from Canada, and with new tariffs, that's going to increase costs for them. And a lot of these publications, newspapers and magazines especially, are really struggling just to break even as it is. They're barely hanging on in a lot of markets because of the internet. That's where people are getting a lot of their news. They're slowly, you know, not necessarily transitioning, but you're seeing more and more that the newspapers are beginning to put a lot of their content behind paywalls on the internet to try to start to monetize that. But it's looking like the publishing industry could start losing more jobs due to these tariffs being passed. So we'll see how that goes. But anyway, those were just a couple of things that popped up on my radar in respect to the publishing industry. So now we're going to move on to our interview today. I'm chatting with my friend Alan Baxter. He's my former co-host on AuthorCast. He's my frequent co-author. And he's an interesting guy. He's got a cool accent since he's British and Australian. And he's coming from a little bit different perspective in that he's done a little bit of indie publishing. He collaborates on indie pub stuff with me, and he writes small press and big press. So he's got a lot of perspectives. He also writes everything from short fiction to novellas to full-length novels. So we are going to hear from Alan now. Okay, now it's recording. Here we go. All right. We are here with Alan Baxter. Alan, welcome to Wood on Words.
Thanks for having me, Dave. It's good to be chatting with you again in the podcast environment.
Yes, it's been a while. Now, for those of you listening who started out with AuthorCast and came on over, Alan needs no introduction. And for those of you who are more recent listeners to the Wood on Words podcast, you've heard him discussed a little bit. He comes up in conversation, mostly nicely. But Alan, why don't you go ahead and give everybody an overview of who you are and what you do?
Okay. Well, I write a variety of things. I write a lot of stuff with your good self, Dave, in the action-adventure and sort of monster thriller genre. We've got a few books out on that front that I'm sure your listeners know about. Under my own name, I tend to write a lot more in the dark fantasy, urban horror, that kind of genre of things. I've got a variety of series out. The Alex Kane series is dark sort of urban fantasy. My latest novel is called Hidden City, which is a urban horror novel that's just come out and got all kinds of gruesome fungus and violent people and things like that in it. I've got a short story collection of dark fantasy and horror short stories out. My previous book before Hidden City was a novella that's sort of in the cosmic horror mystery sort of realm. And I've just signed a new deal for two books with Grey Matter Press in the US.
Awesome. Now, we had Willie Meikle on the show a couple months ago, and you have a lot in common with Willie in terms of your career, not only in the subject matter that you write about. You do a lot of short fiction, you do dark fiction, but also you're published at just about every level, from self-published all the way up to big press. Why don't you give us kind of a sketch of the spectrum of your publication channels that you've taken advantage of?
Sure. Well, from the top down, if you like, I've got the Alex Kane series that I mentioned before was a three-book deal that I signed with HarperCollins in Australia, Harper Voyager. Though they have what they call the ANZ rights, which is Australia and New Zealand and a whole bunch of sort of Pacific islands and things. The North American and the rest of the world rights for that series are with Griffinwood Press. I've got the short story collection that I mentioned is with Ticonderoga Publications here in Australia, who are a good sort of mid-sized, small Australian press. They've been around 20 years or so, producing lots of great books, usually anthologies and collections, just a handful of novels. The novella I mentioned is with PS Publishing in the UK, who do these really beautiful sort of bespoke hardcover editions and ebooks. They don't do regular paperbacks, so the bibliophiles can get the beautiful hardcover and everyone else can happily read along in ebook. And then there's a handful of other sort of things in various small press along those lines. And then I've self-published a couple of things. There's a novella that I serialized on my blog and subsequently released as a self-published single volume. And because I'm also a martial artist and I ran a lot of workshops about writing good fight scenes, I ended up putting that workshop into a short ebook, which I self-published, and that's just available on all the usual ebook channels as well. So, yeah, as you said, the full gamut, really. I think I like to have a wide variety of things going on.
Now, you had a big accomplishment that in last year in that you managed to put two different publishing houses out of business. How did you accomplish that?
I should take that on, actually. If I'm going to get anything out of this, maybe it should be that. Yeah, well, and it's one of the things that that I've really been paying attention to. I know you've talked about it a little bit yourself on this podcast, but I signed the Alex Kane series, was originally signed to the US with Ragnarok Publications, and they released that, and then they released, or then they bought my new novel, Hidden City, but before they released it, they sank. And Cohesion Press, who published our co-written monster novel Primordial, also sank. And they both sank for the same reasons as well, which was they tried to get too big, too fast, produced too many titles, tried to get a big sort of international distribution and into bookstores and things. But the reason small press don't have that kind of distribution is because it takes an enormous amount of capital to finance it. And so the big publishing houses who are run by, you know, ultimately run by the Murdochs of the world, they can throw capital at these things until they start getting money back after a few years, and then they can roll with that. But small press doesn't seem able to survive that process. And both of those presses that I was signed with, I was concerned when they said they were going to do this and go for this big distribution. And one of them assured us they had the money, and the other one sort of made the same sort of claims, don't worry, it's all going to be great. But then they both just couldn't handle it and collapsed, unfortunately. So now, when I do sign with small press, one of the things I look for is to make sure that they are operating like a smart small press, and that they're not going to produce too many books every year, and that they're not going to go after capital-driven distribution and stuff that they probably won't be able to afford and stuff like that. So the new deal I just signed with Grey Matter Press in the US for two books, one of the things I'm most impressed by with them is what a good product they make, and the fact that they recognize their position in the market and capitalize on that really well without trying to be something they're not.
Now, from a business and career perspective, can you contrast, just kind of in broad strokes, the value of the, we'll call it big press, your HarperCollins, your indie presses, and then doing the self-pub or writing with me or something like that? What is the value of each, would you say?
Well, it's true that they do each have different values, and that's why I like to spread this stuff out as much as I can. Admittedly, if I could put everything out through big press, through the HarperCollins or, you know, these other big five publishers, I probably would. A lot of what I write is a bit too sort of niche and weird for those sort of publishers anyway. But the one thing, like HarperCollins in Australia, they have by far opened more doors for me than anything else in terms of where I've been published. They've got me positions as a guest at Comic-Cons and Supernovas. They've got me reviews from major newspapers. They've got me on bookshelves across the country. And a lot of people do still shop in bookstores, so you get discovered that way. So that's definitely an advantage. Obviously, the primary disadvantage is how much of your royalties you don't see as a result of all that work they do for you. Whether you really do sell enough more books to make up the difference, you know, better to sell 1,000 books at 15% than 10 books at 70%. But it's ephemeral. It's very hard to sort of really judge how well those things go. But certainly within Australia, with the Alex Kane series, they've really given good promotion. It's opened a lot of doors, and the books have sold pretty well through stores. So that's a good thing. The downside is they're very slow to change, to adapt. They're very slow to pick up new opportunities. Whereas with small press, they'll make a book that's indistinguishable from a big press if they're good at what they do. But they can take advantage of a lot more opportunities online. They can take advantage of a lot more digital sort of opportunities where they can get that work out across the ebook platforms, and that's really where you're going to sell a lot more with the small presses, through the digital outlets, which the big publishers are not so good at. Apart from anything else, big publishers put ridiculous price tags on their ebooks.
Sorry, I thought I heard you choking there.
Oh, no, that was just me sipping.
Oh, okay. Now, how about the stuff that we do? Technically, it's through Griffinwood, but it's pretty much our own show. We're writing it exactly the way we want. We're paying the editor, so we're in charge. What's good about that sort of partnership, would you say?
Well, that's a good example. That's a really good partnership for me, because the one thing I know, that, like I've heard you say a number of times on this podcast before, when you're talking about the different options people have, one of the things that gets repeated a lot is that the indie path is a really good way to go if you want creative control over things and you have that entrepreneurial spirit to do it. Now, the one thing I've learned over the years is that I don't really have that. I don't like having to understand the technology to upload books and to do layout. I don't like having to do, obviously I do lots of self-promo in terms of marketing, but I don't like being solely responsible for it when it comes to the advertising and stuff like that. Then that's what I like a publisher to do for me. A small press needs to do stuff that I can't do for myself. That's what warrants paying them half your royalties. So if a small press is going to produce a really good looking book with a great cover and with good layout, they're going to promote it well, they're going to take advantage of all the digital strategies that are out there to get you sales and all that sort of stuff, then that's great, because that's what I want the press to do so that I can just get on with writing. And that's what works well, as far as I'm concerned, with you and I. As you say, we've managed to write exactly what we want to write and how we want to write it, but you do all of that stuff. So that means I don't have to. I can just sort of promote on a personal level the way that I do, but I know you're taking care of all the technical stuff that's important. I know you're doing the behind the scenes advertising and promo to help keep these things afloat. I know that you're doing good layout and good books, and when people order a paperback or they get an ebook, we know it's going to be a good product, all that sort of thing.
Now, one of the things I wanted to talk about is your excursion to the States. You went over there primarily to attend StokerCon, so I was hoping you could kind of give us an overview of what you did, what the con was like, and what value you thought it had.
Yeah, sure. I've done a lot of convention stuff here in Australia, and I'm certainly no superstar or a big star, but I've reached a point where I've been to all the conventions, I've done the conventions, I've been a guest of honor at a couple of them. And I'll still keep doing that because, on the one hand, it's really good fun and I've got lots of good friends in the writing scene here who I get to see. Plus, it is great to keep you sort of in the public eye in terms of what books you've got coming out and all that sort of thing. But by the same token, I felt like I was reaching. There was limited sort of reach and limited benefit left to go into those things. I won't stop doing them, but if I want to see continued growth, I needed to find some way sort of to expand. And so I made the decision that at least once a year, I'm going to go to something overseas, like probably a convention, at least once each year. And that way, get to face-to-face network with people I might know online, get to meet editors, publishers, other writers that I either have talked to or haven't yet sort of come across, and I can get introduced to them. Just with that whole networking thing, when you do that stuff face-to-face and you get to meet people and chat about things, when you get to do it in the bar, when you're having a drink and you get to sort of chat, and editors realize that you're fundamentally a normal person and not a psycho and all that sort of stuff, it can really help in terms of opening doors and making you aware of opportunities that you might not have been aware of otherwise. And it can also put you in front of people who might not have been aware of you, so that they might think, oh, you know, that guy was interesting, I'll look at his stuff. And if they then look at my stuff and they like it, that might create opportunities for me in future. When it comes to networking, in many ways, it's about what you can do for other people. You meet people and you see, oh, you know, you should look at this, you should call this person, that person, whatever. But it tends to feedback around as well. And so you can't go there expecting to come back with a handful of offers or expecting to get anything particularly concrete or tangible out of it. But it's just that way of raising your profile within the greater writing and editing and publishing community, and hoping that from that you get to have more interesting opportunities. You might meet and befriend authors who can perhaps blurb a book for you, or you can blurb a book for them, those sorts of things that crop up when you're sitting on your own in your study, sort of making this stuff up. That's the core of what we do. But so much more in publishing is built around that networking and knowing what's going on and who's doing what. And only really face-to-face meeting on that front makes a difference. You can, there's only so much you can do from the computer. There's, you know, 10 minutes sitting in the bar at a con with someone is worth, you know, years of Facebook friendship.
Yeah, there is a certain value to touch base and say, hey, I'm the guy who met you at such and such. Although a lot of times you don't even have to say that if you've met in person and you've gotten along well. Yeah, I mean, it's like there's barriers being broken down when you meet people in person. Now,
That's right. And
go ahead.
There was a couple of good examples with writers who I've had interactions with online, who I respect as writers, who I like as people and thought they were pretty cool people, and, you know, hope that they felt similarly about me, which would never really go beyond that unless we met. But then at StokerCon, I met these people, and, you know, there was a few people who I met there where that professional awareness actually tipped over into something that's definitely a kind of friendship now. And they're people that, you know, we had a drink, we had a laugh, we talked around with other people, we introduced each other to other people who we didn't know, and it just built that whole thing up a bit more, so that you just expand your sort of knowledge of people and of the industry in general.
Yeah, and I think some of the benefits are obvious, especially in traditional publishing. Becoming a known face to an editor, for example. Some of the cons, like Thriller Fest, is totally professionally focused. It's not really reader focused at all. And a lot of people are there to meet people and to meet authors and to meet agents and things like that. But I liked what you said about starting out by offering something. How can you help that person? Give some examples of how you can do that.
Yeah, I think it's a really important thing to be aware of. You get it a lot, especially when you've got new writers in the scene who have been told, okay, you need to go to the conventions, mix some, you know, see who you can meet. And so a lot of people go in with that mindset of what can I get out of this, which is a really bad mindset to go in with, because that it's kind of obvious in your personality. Like, you're looking around who you might get something from. You get those people, they'll only talk to someone who they think might be of benefit, and they'll just kind of brush off other people. And it's really obvious. And especially you see people who've been around the convention circuit for a while become aware of those kind of people very quickly. But the better attitude is to go in and just go, who can I meet? What can I learn? What can I share? And just anyone you meet, just chat to. If you don't know them or you don't know what they do, they might be a best-selling author that you've never heard of, or they might be a new person still looking for their first short story publication. But you have to treat it like it doesn't matter. And because it doesn't matter, you're just going to chat, you're going to find things out, you're going to talk to people, and they mention something they're working on, and you can say, oh, hey, you know, have you heard of this publisher? They're looking for stuff like that. And that could be a fantastic opportunity for that person that they just didn't know about. Or you might be able to say, oh, have you met so-and-so? He writes stuff a bit like what you write. And then they might make friends, and they might benefit from each other out of that. That kind of just purely social interaction with the sort of industry and writing as a focus is the way you should approach it, really. And that's what I like to do. I just love to be in that sort of convention environment and just chat to people and go, oh, you know, so what do you do? And, you know, who are you? who do you know? Who's your friend? Oh, look here, meet my friend. And I went over, one of the reasons that I went to StokerCon this year, there were a number of reasons, but one of them was that two of my good friends, writers from New Zealand called Lee Murray and Dan Raybarts, they were both going, and Lee said to me, you know, you should really come. She's been to a few StokerCons now, and she says, you should really come. It's a great convention. And so they sort of convinced me to go. And that was partly because I knew that as those two were going to be there as well, I wouldn't feel like a fish out of water, you know, the only sort of person. I know those two pretty well, so I knew I'd be comfortable around them. And we spent half the convention just sort of chatting to each other and introducing each other to other people there that we knew or had met, which was brilliant. You just make loads of connections that way.
Now, this podcast being focused on indie publishing, it might be that some listeners are thinking, well, that's not really helpful to me. But I think you can do a lot as an indie in that same space. You can, there are anthologies you can be invited into. A lot of indies do book bundles together or the anthologies together. They promote one another. Sometimes indies like you and I will occasionally publish something with a publisher, and you might want those connections. But just knowing people and being able to connect people can be a very helpful thing, and people appreciate that. Even back when I just had a few books and went to Thriller Fest, we knew a few people, like Joanna Penn, for example, who had a successful podcast. I also was buddies with AJ Hartley, so I was able to connect them for her podcast because she was a huge fan of his work, and that made, and so they both appreciated it. He got some promo. She got to talk to somebody she's always wanted to meet. We had a podcast, so I could extend that invitation to authors. So as an indie, even if you've never been to a con, if you make your online connections that I've talked about, you then might have the opportunity to go to a con and connect other people like, oh, hey, as you said, you should meet this person. I only know him on email, but he's a good guy. Or she's really interested in writing this sort of thing. Let me connect you with her.
That's it. And there's, when I was at StokerCon, there are quite a few people there who are indies, either pure indies doing it themselves, self-publishing, or people who've built a pretty strong career with very small press, where the press has a very small stable of authors who pretty much operate a little bit like what you've talked about when you talk about indie authors coming together and supporting each other and publishing together. Some of the smaller small press are kind of like that, really, in the way that they operate. And especially in genre fiction, there's lots of small press that work like that. And lots of those people go to conventions and meet other small press and other potential authors or editors. You might find a guest editor for an anthology that you want to put out through your own small publishing outfit and that sort of thing. So, yeah, there's really, you will find some conventions where there's a little bit of snobbery and sort of self-publishing is still looked down on. But in my experience, with particularly with genre conventions, a lot of the time, if the indie author just comports themselves professionally, then there's no distinction drawn between them and the person with the multiple book deal with Thomas Dunn or anything like that. Everybody's just writers, just doing the job, just trying to do what we do, you know. And so it always comes back to that same thing of acting professionally and not being a dick, and you won't be judged for, you know, the way you've done something. You'll just be judged for what you do, which is what we all want. You know, we want to be recognized as a normal person, and we want to be recognized as a writer trying to get readers.
Well, I just like to walk around with the screen capture of my bank account statement. That way, if any traditional publisher gets all copies of me, I can just be like, boom! No, not really. I've been tempted a couple times, but like you said, it's pretty rare in my experience that people get all snooty and condescending. What I've seen
a lot of the
time. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, sorry, I was just going to say a lot of the time as well is the older school of author slash publisher that look down on that sort of stuff. You might find, you know, some publisher that's been around, you know, they might be very successful small press and they've been around since the 60s or 70s putting out books, and they look down on people who decide to do it for themselves. Or you might find authors who have been around for ages and they got in on the ground floor of genre publishing and built a name and have just got a career that's continued because they've been around so long. Or you might get someone who's just had that lightning strike of luck and done well from an early traditional publishing deal, who just actually doesn't know the industry anything like people who've been jobbing in it for 20 years. So you can tell pretty quickly the people that are not going to be interested in talking to you about it. And if that's the case, why would you talk to them? There are plenty of other people there who are going to be happy to chat with you.
Interestingly, the very few times that somebody has seemed a little aloof or condescending, it's usually, in my experience, people who have just signed their first book deal and they went TradPub for that validation, and they want to feel like a big-time author, and they're so desperate to be connected to that world that they often will be kind of dismissive of people who aren't big names, and they'll kind of cling on to the few big-name guests trying to say, look, I'm in your circle, I'm part of that now. But that's been pretty limited. But those are the ones I've actually encountered that can be a little snooty about self-publishing.
It's true. Yeah, and a lot of those people will be like, oh, look, if you can't get a trad deal, you shouldn't be doing it. You know, like, if you're not good enough until you can get picked up by a publishing house. And they're completely, or choosing to completely ignore the stroke of luck that was involved in scoring that big publishing deal. Because we've all seen the situation where really shit books get put out by big five publishers and they sell by the thousand. And for whatever reason, there's some little hook, there's something in there that attracted readers and kept people on board. But there could be books that are far better written, far better plotted or whatever, that just didn't land at a publisher for any particular reason. And a lot of it is just luck and timing. So on the one hand, yes, there is a certain validation in getting a big five publishing deal, but equally, that's not any direct reflection on your ability to write a good book. It's a reflection on your ability to land the right book at the right time in the right place.
Yeah, so timing is critical. You know, we've all, or many of us, have had those rejections that say, hey, I really love this book, but I just acquired something almost exactly like it. Or, hey, I think you're worthy of representation, but I already represent somebody who's writing just the same stuff, and I don't feel like I can, you know, represent you both and do you both justice. So, yeah, sometimes it is timing and who you bump into and things like that.
Yeah, it is. There's, I mean, that you have to be able to write a good book, because even if it's what a lot of people seem to think is rubbish, there's got to be something good about it that a publisher will think, okay, I can sell this. So that point there, that's a given. You have to have a good manuscript. After that, there is so much else that's out of your control about whether or not you get a publishing deal with a big publisher or with a small press or with anything else. I regularly submit still short fiction and novel length fiction to various publishers. And more often than not, the rejections I get say something like, this was great, but, or we'd love to publish this, but, and it's just not the right fit, not the right time, or whatever, like the sort of things you've mentioned. So when you get those ones where they do accept something because it was the right time and the right place, then that's great. That's the high. That's the validation you get to keep going. But it doesn't mean that all the times that particular good. It's, you know, this is a sort of, is the standard acceptance is, you know, is the aberration usually, so.
Now, we were talking about going to cons, and let's say a listener decides, I'm going to go to a con as part of my strategy to network. Can you give us some do's and don'ts for con goers who might not have attended one before or might not have attended as an author or a professional?
Sure. The basic ones are really obvious. The basic ones are, you don't have to dress up, but just don't turn up in your sweatpants, because people just aren't going to take you seriously if you look like you just wandered straight out of the basement to get there, because you're in a social setting that is an industry and a professional setting. So you just have to wear clean clothes and look presentable and act like a normal sort of human being. That's the first instance. It shouldn't really need saying, but it's astounding sometimes.
It does need saying, though, that you see walking around.
Well, unfortunately, yeah, and not by the majority by far. It's very much a very small minority, but those people are there. One of the biggest don'ts is don't badmouth anyone, even if you've had a really terrible experience with someone, with another writer or another publisher or for whatever reason. The industry is small, even the parts of it that are big, if you know what I mean, and everybody talks to each other. Everybody knows somebody who knows somebody or whatever. So if you go around and you start bad-mouthing someone, that will get back to those other people. And that's not going to do you any favours, because if a third publisher comes along and they're like, oh, this is the guy who was slagging off so-and-so, they're not going to want to work with you. You're going to develop a reputation for being antagonistic or difficult to work with. If you've had a terrible experience, then just let it go. If you've had a good experience, talk about that, which is my attitude to everything when it comes to reading books, even if you read a book you don't like, just forget about it. If you read a book you do like, tell everyone about it. That's, I think that works across the industry. So just yeah, don't badmouth people, be presentable. And like we mentioned before, don't go in there with this attitude of what can I get out of this? Because I guarantee if you go to a convention and you're professional and polite and friendly and open, you will get heaps out of it. You will get a lot out of it, even if it's not particularly tangible in the first instance. So just go in there with that attitude of what can I learn? Who can I chat to? And just be open like that. Go to the panels. Don't just sort of Miller. The bar is where all the real talk happens, obviously. But also go to the panels, be involved, listen to what other people have to say by attending their panels. If you're on a panel, then they're likely to come and listen to you talk on your panel. And if you do go to a convention, there's usually programming, and you can usually, when you sign up to join the convention, you can usually offer your services as a panelist. And if they offer you some panels and you think you'd have something to say, then accept it. It can be a bit nerve-wracking sometimes. But you get to be involved that way, and people hear you and they'll come and talk to you afterwards. So just be involved in a positive way is really what it boils down to.
And you mentioned panels. The bar can be very scary for people. And maybe if you just want to get your feet wet, one of the things you can do is attend panels where people with whom you'd like to make a connection are panelists. And then you just walk up at the end, introduce yourself and tell them how much you enjoyed the panel or something like that. Maybe there's an intelligent question you can ask, something like that. They might be in a hurry, so you might just want to introduce yourself, say hi, and go from there. But just breaking the ice that way can sometimes be a good start. And then you can approach them later at the bar or whatever. Or if you're submitting a manuscript, you can say, hey, we spoke after such and such panel. Take notes so you can refer back to it. Anything that you can do to connect. But a panel can be a great way to do that in just a very simple way.
That's it. And going to the panels is a good way to break the ice in the bar, social, hotel, lobby situation later. Because if there is someone you'd love to talk to who you think would be really interesting or sort of beneficial to talk to in some way, if you go to their panel and listen to what they've got to say, you learn more about them. You see them in the bar that night then or the next day, and you can go up to them and go, hey, how are you going? I'm so-and-so. Like, I was in your panel yesterday, and I really liked this thing you said about whatever. That something that struck you as interesting, straight away you've got a good reason to start a conversation with that person, and that person knows that you're starting a conversation with them because you've paid attention, you know who they are, and you've got something to talk about. So they're not just going to stand there going, oh, okay, is this guy a weirdo who wants something from me? They're going to go, oh, this guy is maybe someone interesting to talk to. And so, you know, they'll chat to you, they might learn something from you too. You know, this is the thing about cons, it's give and take all the way around. So the panels are there for a reason. There's a lot to be learned there, and it's a good way of breaking ice with people.
And when you initiate this conversation, in my opinion, that is, don't ruin it at the end by pitching your manuscript. Have the conversation.
Never.
And then when you submit through normal channels, you can say, hi, enjoyed meeting you at such and such, appreciate your advice on such and such, that was a great talk. Attached is, and then you do your pitch. But that's the common place for that.
Yeah, you never pitch anything to someone who didn't ask you to pitch to them. If someone asks you, hey, what are you working on? Tell them what you're working on. If you do, usually at conventions as well, you actually get pitch sessions where you can book in.
Sure.
Where you have about 5 minutes, and there'll be a variety of editors and publishers there, and you get about 5 minutes to go and chat to them and say, hey, yeah, this is what my book's about, and you get to deliver your spiel then, and that's the environment for it. And if they like the sound of it, they'll give you a card and say, okay, cool, send me the manuscript. The thing about that as well is if you go to the pitch sessions and you see the editors, the bar later on, when they're standing around being normal, you've already done your pitch, and you've got an in because you can go up to them and say, hey, God, you know, I was really nervous giving my pitch today. Thanks so much for listening, whether they wanted the manuscript or not. And again, it's just another way to chat and to be involved and to learn from them, from what they say or what they might have to say or who they might subsequently introduce you to once you've proven that you're a normal person. So, yeah, you never want to never look at a convention as an opportunity to pitch your manuscript to people other than signing up for actual pitch sessions. You just look at it as a way to learn about the industry and see who's who And as you say, subsequently, when you get back to your desk, then you've got all this knowledge of different people who are doing different things. And you can potentially use that when you approach a publisher or you approach other writers or whatever. That's just sort of conversations that you've had.
Now, I was talking about making connections. We had a really cool experience that began with a connection. It's someone you were acquainted with, but then you spoke to her again at StokerCon. She was going to be in New York City when you and I were, and she said, hey, we're doing this panel that you might like, come on by. And we wound up having a really cool experience just from that little invitation. And I have not told this story yet on the show, if you want to kind of start telling it.
Example of, like... Yeah, okay. Yeah, cool. It is a good story. And it's one of those things, like, there's nothing from a career point of view, there's nothing particularly tangible that's going to come out of this. I'm not going to get a book deal out of it or anything else. But who knows where these things lead to in the future? And if it's nothing else, it was just a really cool experience at the time. And yes, what you're talking about is an editor who I've known from before. We're already friends. So I got chatting with her at StokerCon, and I mentioned that I was going to New York City for a few days after StokerCon. And she said, oh, hey, well, on Tuesday night, there's a science fiction panel. I've forgotten the name of the club. Do you remember what they were called?
Well, at the time, we just thought it was in a church. We didn't even know it was in a club.
The address was because it was in a church, but I knew it was that book club, and I forgot.
The Grolier Club.
Yeah. That's right. And she said, and they've organized a science fiction panel. You might be interested to come along as you're in New York. And I said, oh, that's fantastic. Thank you very much. So then subsequently met up with you when I got to New York, and I mentioned this panel to you, and we decided to go along. So then when we're on our way to the panel, we come up out of the subway and we bump into my friend again. And we're, oh, hey, how's it going? So we all start walking together and chatting. Yeah, we're coming to the panel. Because we were a bit earlier, we ended up just hanging out with her and the other panelists. And then the next thing I know, one of the other panelists is Samuel R. Delaney, who's just this living legend of science fiction. And he just turns up because he's on the panel, and we happen to be there because Ellen invited me, and we're just hanging out and having a cool time. And next thing I know, I'm just standing around chit-chatting with Samuel Delaney, which was just mind-blowing. That was like,
he's
if you're
a legend
fan of
in science fiction, if
yeah, if you, you're any kind of fan of science fiction from back in the day, you realize this guy is one of the few still living absolute legends of that golden age. So yeah, I mean, that was just spectacular. And that was purely from being at a convention, chatting to my friend, and she's saying, oh, you should come along to this panel. And I say, yeah, cool, that'd be good. And I was interested to go along to the panel anyway. And subsequently, I got to meet Sam Delaney and just, like, chat for half an hour, which was amazing.
Yeah, and it was just so funny to me because I didn't realize it was at a club. When she gave us the location, it was the basement of a church. We walk right past the church and go in this side door. But there's like a security desk person there welcoming people and pointing them out. And when we get upstairs, there are these glass cases with all these antique books. Even had Doc Savage in there, which was awesome. And so I'm already really confused because I'm like, this is really interesting in a church. I don't understand what's happening because I know the panel's not happening in here. Then they start bringing in the wine and the glasses. And I turn to the guy who's running the thing and I said, are we in the church? And he looks at me like I'm an idiot. He goes, no, you're in the Grolier Club. We're just using the church's basement for the meeting because our meeting room's... I'm like, oh, now I'm with you. And then, so at that point, you know, we're some of the first to arrive. So one by one, panelists are coming in. And as they get introduced, we introduce ourselves too. And everybody just thinks we belong there. And nobody seems to care that we don't technically. And we weren't being creepy or anything. So... like you said, next thing you know, we're chatting to some really significant people. And hey, we're authors too, so we have something in common. And it was just by being there, like you said.
Yeah, and that's the thing. And we had no reason sort of not to be there, if you like, because and we weren't acting weird. We weren't trying to sell anything. We weren't trying to push anything. We were just hanging out and chatting with people. And when they, you know, they mentioned, oh, do you write? Yeah, I'm a writer too. And you just hang out and you just chat and you just have this experience, and it just expands your awareness of what it is to be in the industry, to be a writer, to be involved in publishing, whether you're going to put your book out yourself or you're going to try to find a publisher to do it for you. It's just this sort of awareness of the greater world of publishing gives you this bigger understanding of how things work and who people are, and people have been around for a while, and you learn things. And like, then subsequently we then sat and we listened to that panel that went on for like 90 minutes, but felt like it just shot by in no time at all, just because there was half a dozen people sitting there with really interesting things to say about science fiction, but about the industry and everything around it as well.
And then we got free alcohol afterward.
Yeah, that was the beauty, wasn't it? Because then afterwards, everybody gathers back in the Grolier Club afterwards, and they've got wine and nibbles and everything like that. So, I mean, yeah, writing and industry and booze, it's a kind of utopia, isn't it, really?
Yeah, so it was really cool. We got to chat with the guests before, and, you know, we spoke with them afterward and made a point to, like, compliment the guy who hosted the panel and say goodbye to the people we've met. So, yeah, it's really cool. And that's one of those things that can happen when you make these connections. And a lot of this may feel like it's more trad pub focused, but you can do the same things with indie. I've met some really great people who are connected in the indie scene, whether it's other authors in my genre or podcasters, different people like that. Or another thing we didn't mention with cons is sometimes you get to meet with professionals who can help you. Like, I had a meeting with the iBooks people at the last Thriller Fest. They actually reached out to me because they saw I was going to be there. So there are opportunities, even as an indie, just to get to know people, but also meeting people like that, like you said, it's just really cool. It's nice to be a part of something like that.
Exactly. It reminds you you're part of something bigger. And the simple fact is that you can't know then, and often you'll actually never know what benefit might come of it to you or to other people from the interactions that you had. But the nature of publishing, whether you're going indie or trad, is that it's not a short con. It's a long game. You have to work hard. You have to keep going at it. And every opportunity that comes along that may or may not move your career along, sometimes you don't recognize them. But unless you're involved in it, you're not going to get certain opportunities that might come along otherwise. You might, as you mentioned earlier, you meet someone, they chat to you, they think you're a decent person, they hear about what you do, they've never heard about you before, so they go home and don't think too much about it. And then 3 months down the line, they see something go past on Facebook or Twitter, and they see it's a book cover with your name on it. They're like, oh, well, that's that guy that I met at StokerCon, I should really check it out. So maybe they buy that new book that you just released.
Or they share it around because they thought you were a nice guy and they want to do something nice for you.
Exactly. Or they simply share it because they liked you. But then if they read it and they enjoy it, they go, this guy's pretty good. And maybe they're putting together an anthology and they go, I'll send that guy an invite. And so they send you an invite to send in a story for the anthology. And you have time, so you write the story. You might get lucky and it gets accepted. So you make a few hundred dollars selling the short story. But then people read that anthology who would never have seen your work before, but they read your story in this anthology and they go, hey, that story was really cool. I wonder what else this guy has done. So they look up your name and they see this back catalogue of books that you've written. This fractal like spread of what happens. That's how the long game works, because it's a snowball, but it's going down a really shallow hill. So it takes a long time to roll down, but it slowly gets bigger and bigger as it goes. And if you don't give yourself these opportunities that you might not be able to see at the time, then you're making that hill sort of shallower still, you know? So you don't actively seek out benefits, you just be involved. And who knows where these things will lead.
Yeah, that was an awesome time. Of course, we just had fun hanging out, seeing New York, and coming up with ideas for Jake Crowley book 3. Hard to believe that's already going to be book 3 when we get to that one.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, we could do it. Aston 2 sort of underway at the moment, and before you know it, we'll be on Crowley 3. What's going on?
Yeah, well, hey, you like those royalty checks, don't you?
I sure do.
Well, since we have a lot of indies listening, or a lot of writers, period, say a little bit more about your book on writing fight scenes, because I think that could be of interest to a lot of people.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Well, it's called Write the Fight Right. As I said, when my original early books, which were done indie, my first novel, I did self-publish before you picked it up with Griffinwood. From that point on, I started getting a lot of people telling me that I wrote really good fight scenes, which is obviously understandable because I'm a career martial artist. I run a Kung Fu academy. That's what I do. I teach martial arts as well as write. So I understand, you know, I've had a fight history. So I understand that stuff. And so when it comes to writing it, I've got a lot of stuff to give, you know, in terms of what works and what doesn't, and interesting angles that people can include in their fight scenes and everything else. And at a convention years ago, more than 10 years ago, a writer friend of mine said, hey, on the Friday, we're putting together a workshop stream. Will you do a workshop on writing fight scenes? I was, yeah, okay, sure, no problem. So I put together this workshop, and it was very popular, it was very successful. I've done it dozens of times since, at all kinds of things. I've now done that workshop at a WorldCon and at writers' centres all over the country and all sorts of things. And every time I did the workshop, I would have like a sheet of notes that I would hand out to people, and I would encourage people to make their own notes and everything else, of course. But every time, or almost every time, after the workshop, people would say to me, hey, is there any further reading? Have you written this stuff down? And I kept saying, no, but I should. And finally, I did. I basically put together a short ebook, and it's only sort of 12,000 words. It's more like a very long essay rather than a full textbook, but it basically takes all the things I cover in the workshop, expands on them, gives some details about different ways of fighting, different ways of talking about environment, talking about what it's like to get adrenaline, talking about the emotions of fighting, talking about the truth about knockouts and all that sort of stuff. And I put all that together in this into an ebook, and it's on all the various ebook platforms at $2.99. So it's you'll find it on Amazon and Smashwords and iBooks and all those sorts of places wherever you would normally go for those things.
Sure, and you know, I think there are a lot of misconceptions about fighting. A lot of people, I've actually met a lot of people who've never been in a fight, which is weird to me. I guess maybe I was raised badly or something. But then a lot of people have only been in fights as children, where you can't really do a lot of damage to each other. And the reality of an actual fight is something very, very different than what we might have experienced as a kid or see in movies.
Yeah, and that's the fundamental thing that I cover in this book. The vast majority of people, a lot of people haven't been in fights, which is, you know, ideally, really, that's the norm. If you can avoid being in fights, that's not a bad thing. A lot of people haven't fought, and therefore they don't have much to draw on. So they try to research fighting, hopefully the same way that they'd research anything else that they want to write about. But the majority of people research fighting by watching the fight scenes in movies and kung fu movies and all sorts of stuff like that, which is all very exciting, but it's designed for that two-dimensional medium where you look in from the outside. And that's the opposite of writing. When we write, we get to be in amongst it with the characters. We get to be in the character's head. We get to have the five senses and not just see it from the outside and all that sort of stuff. So a lot of the time, written fight scenes are bad because they're just like badly transcribed movie fights, and it doesn't work. Whereas if you understand how fighting really works, what it really feels like, and then you put your writing skills to that, then that's good. But of course, if you're going to research that to write it well, you have to go and fight. And, you know, it's best not to go and just pick brawls on the streets with people just to sort of learn. You could go and take martial arts lessons and do some competition and stuff. But of course, I think that's a great idea. But that's because that's my job. A lot of people haven't got that much time to put into one aspect of their writing. And so that's what I tried to address with this book. It'd give people that sort of short but detailed research manuscript, basically, that they can use to make their fight scenes realistic and believable.
Yeah, and to be clear, I haven't been in a street fight in over 30 years, but I also taught martial arts, so I'm talking about the sparring and things like that, and, you know, which is not exactly the same, but you get a pretty good idea of the fatigue amount of delivering blows, what it really feels like to take one, and, you know, how a really clean hit might end the fight right there. You're not going to pummel each other for an hour and a half.
And the smells and sounds of how it, and the feelings and the emotion and everything that goes, you get to understand what adrenaline feels like. And all that stuff is really powerful for character development. It's really powerful for, you know, you want different ways to tell readers about your characters. And one of the best ways to do that is through fighting, because you can use it as an analogy for character.
All right. Well, you can tell we haven't been on a podcast together in ages because we're coming up on an hour already, and I usually cut these things off at about 25 minutes. So yeah. Let's wrap this up by telling everyone where they can find you online.
Okay. Best place to start is alanbaxteronline.com. That's A-L-A-N-B-A-X-T-E-R online.com. That's everything is there. You can find me at Alan Baxter on Twitter, or just look up the author page on Amazon. You can find all my books and stuff listed there, as well as on my website and everything else. So those are probably the best places to go and have a look.
All right. I will put those links up on whatonwords.com, as well as the link to Right the Fight Right and Hidden City. And we appreciate you chatting with us.
No worries. Thanks for having me on. It's been fun to chat like this again.
All right. I hope that was fun for everyone, and I hope you got a little something out of it. Please check out Alan's books. And especially if you write books with fight scenes, check out Write the Fight Right. We've got a link to it up on the post on whatonwords.com. And a big thank you for listening, and we will see you next time.